Welcome. My name is Sharon, and I serve the village's education lead, and it's my pleasure to introduce Dave Peterson from Wenatchee, Research Forester at USD Forest Service. Welcome. He's here with his family and two adorable 7-year-old twin daughters. There they open it on us like that.
Be good, Dad.
Welcome. Dave is doing three presentations this week, and the first one today is the Wolverine Fire Historical and Ecological Context.
Thank you, Sharon.
Well, tonight I want to begin a conversation in a series on talking, kind of centered on the Wolverine Fire. And when I talked about doing this, it was sort of, well, how do you do 3 or 5 sessions on this? And being not very original, I decided to go with sort of a chronological approach to things. So today is going to be kind of the background, sort of everything right up to the, it's like a Star Wars movie, everything up to where it really gets interesting. So all the background. Yeah, exactly. I'm spoiling it right now. There's a cliffhanger at the end. But basically talking about sort of how fire has worked in these forest ecosystems of the Northwest, you know, why things happen the way they do, and that sort of thing. So I'll actually have a outline slide. So some of the questions I hope we'll get to today is, you know, when did the current forest vegetation and fire regimes develop in the Northwest? What are some of the major controls on fire occurrence, size, and behavior? How have humans shaped modern vegetation and fire regimes? That's a pretty big one. And then, you know, sort of, once we get through all that, I'll sort of say, bring it back home and say, so how does all this apply to Railroad Creek Valley and the Wolverine Fire? And sort of the setup for the Wolverine. And then I really fully expect that we'll have a lot of time for questions and answers at the end and a lot of discussion. I hope there'll be some topics that elicit some questions or some opinions, because that's going to be a lot of the fun of this. In the meantime, we'll get started, but do feel free, if I'm being unclear about some, I'm not going to get shaken if you want to interrupt with a clarification question. If it's a big topic, maybe save it for that at the end. But if it's something I'm just not being clear about and you really want to, you think others might be unclear too, by all means interrupt me, because I'll get back on track.
Well, basically, being from Texas right now, we've been on divorce from the Wolverine Fire. The time and when it happened and so forth, you know.
When it gets to that.
Or are you going to tell us?
Oh, well,
tomorrow.
No, I mean, no, sure. So, no, that's probably a real good point. Thank you. So the Wolverine Fire burned 2 summers ago, summer 2015, and it, without giving away all of Wednesday's talk, it basically started down on Lake Chelan at the very end of June, and kind of what we call skunked around on Lake Chelan for about a month, and then decided it wanted to go someplace, and like any good Wolverine, it started moving up and down valleys. And it chose to move up this valley and down the Entiat Valley, and by the time it was all said and done, it had burned about 60,000 acres. So that's the Wolverine Fire, and Wednesday we'll talk a lot about sort of the many heroic efforts by people here at the village, including these two sitting here, who put themselves on the line to save the village.
We've the cheese.
So Wednesday we'll talk about the actual fire itself, and particularly from a Forest Service point of view, how the fire management was handled, sort of some of the decision spaces and how that, and then sort of what it left behind. And then on Friday we'll come back with the third session, which is kind of the aftermath, and talk a little bit about how vegetation is adapted to fire, what we expect to see happening here in the next decade or two. Sort of how stuff comes back, and then some, maybe if we have time, some topics about post-fire forest management and some of the things we might do to either prevent bad things from happening from the fire or to accelerate restoration and recovery of the fire. So that's the nutshell of my three sessions. Thank you for that question. Okay, so fire has not always been an important part of the ecosystem in this north end. And so I'm going to start the talk, just like the Bible, with sort of in the beginning. So about 15,000 years ago, nobody was worried about fire here, because there was probably about a half a mile of ice sitting on top of this valley. And in fact, most, you know, the northern part of North America was just covered with ice. So those of you from the, you know, from the West Coast, we had the Cordilleran ice sheet. Those of you from the Midwest, you were bracing us with the Laurentide ice sheet, and we had the big Greenland ice sheet out there. And those, of course, that was the last ice age is what we call it. It probably hit its peak around 15,000 years ago, sort of declined. And by about 10,000 years ago, it was ice was starting to melt off of here. But actually, I think, if I remember my Rudy Edmund talks well enough when I was a kid, you know, it was about 10,000 years ago this valley was still full of ice. And then it started melting off, and we started developing what we see today. Just a little historical perspective. From a fire perspective, one of the things that's worth noting about those ice sheets is that particularly the Laurentide ice sheet in the center of the country was so huge that it actually affected weather very significantly. It was so big it created this big old cold air pocket in the middle that basically split the jet stream. So what we think of as the normal jet stream that comes across North America today, you know, and you always see it in your weather forecast. Oh, the jet stream's coming right at us with a Pineapple Express. Oh, we got the Arctic plunge coming down or something. That's all talking about these dominant airstream patterns that we just call the jet stream. Well, because that ice batch was so bad, it actually created what I guess would be a fixed low pressure zone with this anti-cyclonic thing. So it basically was blowing wind out off the continent toward the northwest, which is really the opposite of what we have right now. And so not only was it covered with ice, but we also got all these dry, cold winds. And so whatever vegetation was along here, you know, we're probably looking at like eastern Montana or northern Alaska someplace, you know, tundra, shrub grasslands, maybe a little bit like an alpine meadow in some places, but, you know, no trees, some shrubs, lots of, you know, herbaceous vegetation and a lot of exposed rock. So that's the story about 10,000 years ago. And a friend of mine, Susan Pritchard, did a kind of cool study for her PhD about 30 miles as the crow flies north of here in North Cascades National Park, where she went to a place called Panther Potholes, which is just a series of ponds up on a ridge, about a 4,000 foot little saddle above Lake Diablo and Ross Lake, if you're familiar with those campgrounds there. So it's just on about a 2 mile trail. There's these little ponds about the size of this room probably. But the cool thing about them is that they get water in, but there's no outlet stream. So the water just kind of comes and sinks down. And what they collect all the time, tell me, what do they collect all the time?
Pollen.
Pollen, that's right. Somebody with hay fever knows all about that. Oh yeah, well you can read too. So those of you with hay fever realize that pollen goes everywhere, right? It can spread for miles. And so what these little ponds do is they collect pollen from, depends on the pond, but somewhere between a mile or two radius area, sometimes maybe a little further. But they kind of are a little measurer of the regional vegetation. What's kind of close to here that can blow around in the wind and land on this pond and settle down into the muck. And if you drill down and get enough muck out of there, you know, long cores, and you really painstakingly section them off, and they do some radiocarbon dating to figure out how old everything is, and there's little layers of Mazama ash that tells you this is the 7,000 years ago piece, and this is the St. Helens ash. They can kind of figure out how things have changed over time. And they love these pollen diagrams. I'm not going to try to explain them to you. But what the upshot of the whole thing is that here about 8,000 years, remember I said about 10,000 years ago we still had a lot of ice. So this is probably, there's low pollen counts around here. It's probably picking up stuff off ridge tops, stuff sort of surrounding, like stuff you'd see surrounding a glacier. By about 8,000 years ago, we're starting to see, there's a little bit of this, but they think this is probably lodgepole pine, some birches, some alders, so sort of shrubby little vegetation and some various kinds of herbs. About 8,000 years ago, we start getting western white pine, some Douglas fir, some true firs in there, so it's starting to get a little more foresty. Again, those are probably a lot in tree clumps, probably not continuous forest yet, but they were starting to get some patches of forest in the area. And then what she concluded was really the modern vegetation started about 4,500 years ago when we started getting things like western hemlock and western red cedar. This is, again, this is Ross Lake, so it's a little bit west of the crest. They get these more like lowland west side species in there. So that's kind of the modern climate and the modern forest. And the only other point I want to make on that is that this is another figure she had. It's really hard to see on the slide, but this wavy black line shows you through time how much fire was going on in the area, because these ponds also collect charcoal. They also collect little fossil sediments from, you know, when fire comes through and beetles drop off trees and stuff, they go into the pond, they sink. So she did a lot of counting of that. And again, you can kind of see that it looks like there was a lot of fire here in this early post-glacial stuff when all we had were those like pine, those like lodgepole pines, which burned pretty well. And then we had a long period with not very much fire at all. And then we're kind of into the modern fire period. But even then, it's going up and down from century to century and millennium to millennium. So the basic lessons we have from that are that the current forest vegetation in the Northwest developed after that glacial period, and what the paleo, when they do this on like ponds all over the Northwest, what they basically said is climate is the big driver over long time periods and over big areas, but fire does a lot within time periods and within areas. So, you know, climate kind of trumps over the long haul, but what you see at any given time and place is really influenced by fire in areas that, or by the lack of fire if you're in an area that doesn't burn. So what controls fire currents and behavior? Well, we fire ecologists and fire managers in general love triangles. It's kind of like pastors, like three-point sermons. So fire ecologists like three-point figures. So basically topography, weather or climate, and fuels. The big three. No, that's not good. So let's talk about each of those a little bit. So fuels are one of the big things. Can't burn if there's nothing to burn. And that's really about vegetation, because vegetation, both the live vegetation and whatever kind of litter it's producing from year to year, leaves dropping, needles dropping, twigs dropping, that really determines what kind of fuel type, size, shape, how it's going to pack down on the ground, how much of it there is. What kind of chemical, you know, is it really flash? Is it some of the shrubs just, you know, are like kerosene? You know, into this, you know, a lodgepole pine needles are made to burn, easy to burn. Other stuff, you know, real fine needles may pack down really hard, hold a lot of moisture, don't burn very well at all. So what's there is important. Also, how productive the forest is. That gets into a little bit of climate too, but. Forest productivity is basically to say how much fuel. So, you know, you could have very burnable, putting the fizzle one tree here, one tree over there, and one tree over there, and there's nothing in between, you're not going to have a lot of fuel. So, how much, how good? Pretty easy. Climate's another one, and again, there we're mostly talking about temperature and moisture. We talked about how the moisture balance is going to affect how productive the system is, how dense the trees are going to get, how dense the shrubs and grasses are going to get, so how much fuel is going to be produced. But a really key point about climate is, does the fuel ever dry out? And how long does it stay dry, and how much of it stays dry? So if you're over in the Western Cascades in the foot of the thing, there's a whole lot of fuel on the ground. You can have dead trees everywhere, there's little trees growing on dead trees, there's wood everywhere. But it doesn't burn very often because it stays wet. And you know, the little twigs will dry out, but those big logs, they'll be wet through most of the summer. So even if a fire comes along, you know, anybody's tried to light a campfire in wet wood, not so much fun. And even if you did get it, the water soaks up so much of the heat in evaporating the water that it doesn't propagate very well. So even if you could get a little spot going, it's going to have trouble moving. So weather and climate are really important for figuring out how dry it gets in this. Usually around here it's the summer, but in the Midwest it's the spring. In the South it's the winter. So it depends, but there's some kind of a dry season, and it's how much, how dry does that fuel get? So how available is that fuel that's on the ground to fire? And does that correspond with times when we get ignitions? So our natural ignitions are usually things like lightning. We have plenty of other ignition sources like railroad tracks or cigarette butts or whatever. But does lightning come at the same time the fuel is dry? Or do people lose campfires escape at the same time as the fuel is dry? So that depends, determines things. And the other big one that we're just becoming more and more aware of is drought. And particularly, not just like normal summer drought, but these regional droughts. This picture here was from 2015, and I'll probably come back to it on Wednesday, but look at, I mean, if those of you remember the headlines, California was just suffering about the fourth year of a mega drought. I mean, they were just, everything was so dry. There were pictures of weather stations in March that would normally have, you know, 4 feet of snow on the ground, and the flowers were blooming, you know, because they didn't get any and stuff. And so, you know, these kinds of situations set us up for large wildfires, not for a variety of reasons, including fuel availability. Everything is just so dry. They start out, even up here, we've had years where there was so little snow that really the big fuels never got all the way wet. And so they normally over winter, you kind of reset by getting everything really wet, and then you wait for it to dry out again. And some years in these droughts, things never wet up, so they dry out. They're already pre-dried. And then topography, these are some fun slides. If you've ever taken a fire management class, you may have seen these. I stole these from a friend of mine. But they kind of show in cartoon. So topography is really important for fire movement. One of the things is steep slopes promote rapid uphill fire. And the reason is, anybody ever held their hand over a candle? You know, if you hold it right over there, that's the really hot spot. Well, it's the same thing with a wildfire. And if you think of a slope like this and your flames are burning here, they're not very far from that next piece of fuel. And so, you know, the fuel has to be kind of preheated in order to combust, right? So that's why we have to use like a match, and then we have kindling or paper and then kindling, because, you know, the match can light the paper pretty easily, and the paper can light the little fine stuff really well because they can preheat it, and then that generates enough heat to light the bigger stuff. Well, it's the same way with a fire going up the hill. Wind can accentuate this too, but just going up a hill, those flames are closer to the next piece of fuel, and so it tends to move up really quickly. The opposite of that, maybe go to this slide. You know, where on the slope you are is important too, because this fire here has a potential, you know, on a calm day to make a nice run up the hill. This fire up here doesn't have much to go to the top. It could still back down the hill, but then you have the opposite thing. The flame is shooting the heat this way, and your fuel is that way. So that's part of topography and fire behavior. Aspect is another part of topography that's real important for kind of contradictory reasons. So north-facing slopes, like one behind us here, tend to be cooler and wetter. The sun, remember, go, you know, in the northern hemisphere, the sun's real low in the wintertime, so it doesn't get much sunshine, so a lot of snow can accumulate there without getting direct radiation to melt it. It tends to melt out a little later in the spring. There's not, well, you know, once we get to midsummer, it's getting the same sun as anything else, but that extra moisture allows the forest to grow denser. They produce more wood, more shade, so they hold their moisture underneath longer. So in general, they have a much shorter fire season, they're more productive, they generate more fuel. When they do go up, they can be that there's a lot more fuel there potentially to burn. The opposite would be slopes like here on Martin Ridge and Lightning Ridge there, where they get all that winter sun. The snow tends to melt off more as it goes, a lot more exposed rock, bigger gaps between forests. So, from a fire behavior standpoint, where you're, you know, whether you're on the north or south facing slope can be kind of important. And then there's some subtleties within topography, like creek valleys, or especially small creek, these what they call draws or chimneys. And so if you have a little bit of a thing, it really will function like a chimney at home to try to draw air and heat. And so we tend to get, especially if they're going uphill, fires will tend to follow these, I guess they'd be concavities in the slope. And so that's another thing that firefighters worry about a lot, because that's where you don't want to be standing here. You might want to be over here, but you definitely don't want to be there at the top of a chimney. And we'll often see, and I don't know if there's some good examples down here about a couple miles down the valley where there were some stringers, where you'll see strips of trees burn up the. Mm-hmm. It wasn't quite as noticeable in this valley as some places. There's some other places where you can really see it, but you'll see fires make little runs. And often those are associated with little creek valleys and stuff. And some of that's fuel, but some of that's also this chimney effect. And then finally, I want to add one more, so this is not a triangle anymore. It's, unless you create a different triangle, maybe it's a pyramid. And that's landscapes. So the fire guys always talk about where does fire come from and where does it go to? Because the reality is, although we can get some really big cluster lightning storms, in general, most of these fires that we deal with start with 1, 3, 5 points. There aren't that many points that start. And so it's really important, if you're worried about Holden here, where is the fire coming from when it hits Holden? What kind of condition is it in? And where is it going to next? And so we worry about landscape condition as much as we do about any particular place on the landscape, because you can have a really well-protected village, and if you've ignored the area around it, you might have a big problem. And we've seen that with a lot of urban wildfires where, people might have had their own lawns really nice, but they didn't pay attention to the mile of fuel next to them. And by the time the fire gets there, it's like, oh, I don't care if there's no fuel, I'll just kind of keep moving. Because there's so much heat, pretty much anything will burn. And so we want to really pay attention to landscape connectivity. Is everything one big even continuous thing, or are things broken up so into patches? I want to show one of the things we tend to do is kind of lump things into categories because it makes it easier. And once again, there's three categories. So high severity fire regimes are kind of this. They're typically in either high elevation, cooler, or wetter areas like the west side of the Cascades, where it's a very short fire season. Things are often wet. And basically, when you get fire is when you have like a drought or some sort of really unusual thing. But the fires are only coming maybe every 100 to 500 years or 200 to 500 years. So it's lots of time in between for things to recover, for fuels to accumulate. The fires are so far apart, there's no particular advantage to a species that deals with fire better, because all these other plants can complete their life cycles sometimes many times over in that 100 to 500 years. And so, I'm looking at you. So we call these high severity fire regimes. They're not, it doesn't mean you can't have a low severity fire. You can certainly have an ignition at a time when it's sort of burnable, and you can have a low severity fire come. But the characteristic fires in those ecosystems are really high severity. And just a couple of examples in this upper photo, if you can see it, I'm not sure with the light if it shows, but there's kind of a big, you can see kind of a, just the texture varies. I like the light. Okay, thanks. Anyway, there's an area where a big patch is burned out of that hillside, and you can see where basically that entire side of that middle patch there just burned up at one point in time. Now it's coming back. Down below is more of a boreal forest kind of situation where you have relatively flat ground, and this is probably like black spruce and lodgepole pine up in, say, like northern BC, that, or half of Canada for that matter. They get a lot of these. You've heard about ones up there they had a couple years ago in the Northwest Territories. Big fires. And that's kind of what they're about. The opposite end of the spectrum is the one that we deal with down, or we try to deal with down in Wenatchee, which is a low severity fire regime. And the idea is that fires are typically real high frequency. They come every 2 to 15 years historically, so very frequent fire. They typically, because there's not much time between fire for fuels to build up, they tend to be very low severity. They don't release a lot of heat at any, but they develop, the vegetation typically develops for fire, so you may have like grasses in the understory that year after the fire, they're, hey, I'm happy, you know, I'm back. We're good, you know, and so a year or two later, you can run fire through every year or two, no problem. And those of you in the Midwest, I did my PhD work in tall grass prairie, same kind of thing. You burn it, it actually grows better. And so you can burn that stuff pretty much every year, at least for 10 or 15, 20 years, and it's happy as a clam. So that's a low severity fire regime. Lots of fire, but the fuel doesn't ever really accumulate enough to cause big problems. And then you have mixed severity fire, which is where we kind of throw everything else. And I can tell you in the last 10 years, we scientists have been really trying to get, everybody's been trying to come up with a really good definition for a mixed severity fire regime. And the problem is there's lots of definition. I mean, there's lots of ways of looking at it. This is a picture up here of, that must be copper and buckskin, that the Chelan Ranger took right after the fire. This is one example of a mixed severity where there's little patches. So one area burned really hot, another area burned really low. So you can have spatial variability in how severe fire was. And that could be a recurring pattern. That could happen every time or it could only happen once. Another way of looking at a mixed severity fire regime is one where the weather and fuel conditions vary a lot from year to year or decade to decade. So you might have a whole bunch of decades of low severity fire, and then you get a wetter decade or so, and there's no fire and everything builds up, and then whammo, the next fire comes through, all of a sudden it's high severity. So it could be through time, it could be variable, it could be variable through space. They're really hard to figure out how to manage these. And yet that's really what Railroad Creek Valley sits in. And just kind of a conceptual diagram for those of you who like these sorts of things, that the way we order these fire regimes, you typically, warm, dry climates tend to have these low severity, high frequency, and high severity is typically in cool and moist, but I'm sure that at least a half a dozen of you can come up with really good examples of ones that don't. I mean, Chaparral in California doesn't fit this mold. Anyway, a lot of the shrub communities kind of would be somewhere else. But for the forest communities in the Northwest, this one works really well. So now we want to talk about human influences. And many of a lot of this might be pretty similar to what you're used to at home. So at the end of the Ice Age, you know, things settle out. We've got all the trees and stuff where they're supposed to be. Climate's driving things, right? And so we have that, like this previous slide. You have these, you know, typically warmer, drier areas that are burning a lot. And the cooler weather areas not burning so much. But the one thing I want to point out about that is that if you take humans out of the equation and all our accompanying towns and roads and farm fields and everything else, think about what happens to a fire. So theoretically, any time during the dry season in Wenatchee, there's about 6 months of it, maybe more, a lightning strike could come down and start a fire. And so if that fire started, it's not necessarily going to start in the middle of summer. It could start in, it could start in March, because it hasn't greened up yet, it's still dry from the year before, the snow's melted off, you get a fire. So what's it gonna do? Well, it's gonna burn until it runs out of fuel or until the next rainstorm comes and puts it out. So it's not necessarily gonna burn under really hot, nasty conditions. So, and you have to think about sort of probabilistically, without humans in the equation, a lot of that probably happened a lot. And so you had a lot of these fires burning at times of the year we wouldn't normally think of fires burning just because of chance. And they're going to keep burning and probably move around kind of crazy like the Wolverine did until something comes and puts them out. And they might burn all summer if they get into some heavy stuff, or they might burn up to the snow line. And so historically we had a lot more frequent fire up in these middle and upper elevations. And so you know, if you go around up here on this slope, there's a lot of ponderosa pine in there that you wouldn't necessarily think of it if you see this, the stuff along the vegetation, but there was a lot of ponderosa pine in this valley. Kind of suggests that it burned a lot. So just want to make that point. So then what happened is, first we had Native Americans come along, and I'm not going to say too much about that, other than, you know, we can talk later about how much they used fire and how much they modified vegetation, because that's a good topic. But I want to start talking about Euro-American settlement. That's where we know we had a big effect. I mean, people came along, wanted to put in crops, right? So plow up field, make barriers to the spread of fire, build roads, make barriers to the spread of fire, build cities, don't want fire in the cities. Let's raise a really big crop of sheep and let's run them up and down the mountain valleys all summer. They'll eat everything, no fuel, it changes the fire. Also tends to expose a lot of dirt and causes, so I mean, some big changes just by fairly basic. We also, I mean, if you think about living in Wenatchee, I always admire the irrigation system. You know, we brought water from the mountains all the way out to this dry country and put orchards in. It's a great economic model, but think about what that's doing to natural fire regimes. All of a sudden you have big patches of green in the middle of brown. So all of that changed the way fire operated on the landscape. I don't know how bad it is around here, but in many parts of the Southwest, of course, exotic species have been introduced that have totally changed how fire moves. So sagebrush ecosystem has been highly modified by cheatgrass, because cheatgrass grows pretty much everywhere and it carries fire really well. So these systems that used to burn only every 20 or 30 years in a really bad thing could pretty much burn any year. So a couple slides here just to kind of illustrate this point. So I believe this is in the upper left corner of this, you see a picture from sort of one of the earliest pictures we have of this particular forest. You can see there's some big trees there, a lot of open spaces, some low shrubs. If you move over to the upper right, you can see it's starting to fill in. And then down here in the lower left, you can see it's not only filled in, but we've got these smaller trees growing up through the bottom. And then on the lower right, you can see where a fire has come through and actually taken out. That upper left picture probably could have taken a pretty good fire and with most of the trees surviving. By the time you get to the lower left, fire is pretty deadly. And if you look on the landscape, these are some pictures that are about 70 years apart from the north central Washington. Remember the photographer's 1934 photo on top from a ridge top. And just looking, what I want you to notice is how many open patches there are there. Where, hopefully you can see it. It's the lighter stuff. The dark stuff is basically, the really dark parts are trees. The lighter stuff is either rock or shrub type fields. And then look at that same, John Marshall from Wenatchee has gone back and looked at a lot of these historic photos and retaken them. And so that's on the bottom. You can see all that open area is closed in. And so think about that from the perspective of fire moving across a landscape. You know, there's no problem finding fuels here. Whereas up above there, the fire would have run into the previous fire or the fire before that, and would have had to move like this through the landscape to get around, as opposed to going. This is just some modeling that Paul Hesburgh has done. The main thing I want to point out is, notice in the upper thing here, the orange and red, that's sort of your high severity fire areas, and those are basically shrub steppe stuff out in the Columbia Basin. It's a lot of sagebrush and that sort of thing, where that's where we get high severity. But all this area along the Cascades is kind of in the greens and blues, and that's where we are. And so that's basically low and mixed severity fire. And then when they look at the current situation, these yellows and oranges are all kind of high severity fire. So it's still not real frequent, but we've changed the nature of fire in these systems by letting these forests grow up. Letting them grow up also creates a lot of bug disease problems where they kill. So if fire doesn't come along and kill something, typically the bugs will do the job for them instead. And then the last thing, I guess, it's probably the first thing that many of you thought about was humans, we continue our efforts to alter fire activity, even knowing the importance of fire. We've known since the 70s, I think there's been a pretty good social awakening as that fire is an important part of ecosystems, that fire plays an important ecological role. And yet, our management techniques really still, we've refined our techniques, but our basic management philosophies haven't really changed. Certainly, the Forest Service has made some changes, but essentially the public still wants the fires out. And so any land management agency realizes that if they let it burn, they, for any reason, they better have a really good reason, and they better be willing to resign over it, because the public really wants fires put out. We're getting better, but that's still really the case. So we spend billions of dollars every year nationwide fighting wildfires. Some of that's allocated by Congress. Some of it, they just, when that money runs out, they start taking it away from other funds and then reimburse it later. So, but the thing to note is we don't have very many. What we have is a whole lot of really small fires where basically we got on right away and put them out. 98-99% of those fires, they're out before they hit an acre, or certainly before they hit 10 acres. We have a lot of really small fires where lightning comes down, hot shots get on it, it's gone. Or it's just what there was nowhere for it to go. Like, I know of a couple of fires that have happened up on Martin Ridge where come out of S with, oh yeah, look at that, tree's burning up there. Okay, no problem. It's out by the next morning. But the problem we have when we suppress all those, remember I talked about that fire that might light in Wenatchee without humans in March and skunk around all summer and kind of burn. Most of the area that's going to burn is going to burn under sort of less than optimal weather conditions. So it's not going to be nearly as hot as it could be. If the problem we have with fire suppression is we tend to channel all our fires into the hottest time of the summer, the lowest humidity conditions, the highest wind conditions, and the time when there's the biggest demand for fire resources. So, we might have a bad fire problem here, but if they have a bad fire problem in California and Nevada and Montana and Idaho, and oh, by the way, maybe even in the Midwest, you can bring all the Australians in you want, there's still going to be a lack of resources to fight it. So what happens is most of our acreage burns at the absolute worst time, because that's the time we can't put it out. And so we get these, what we have is this era of mega fires that are, bigger than 50 or 100,000, because they're usually happening at the same time as a bunch of other mega fires. And if you look at that map I have over here, you can look at it afterward if you want, but you probably see from a distance those three big, so this is, for reference, this is Wolverine in 2015. This is the Chelan complex in 2015. This is First Creek. And these are three really big fires out in north central Washington, all basically burning in the same 2 to 3 month period. That's an example of just overwhelming a system. And that's what we do when we put out all these sort of off-season fires. So the last thing, I guess, would be the expansion of the wild and urban interface. And that's basically where people have chosen, for various reasons, to exist right where the fuels and the wildfire is. One case I know you're all familiar with, this is near my house, and a good chunk of this neighborhood burned 2 years ago. But basically, more and more, where's the cheap land? Well, it's out of ways. Where's the beautiful scenery? Oh, it's out of ways. Where can we least protect structures? Oh, out of ways. So people want cabins, they want scenic beauty, they want affordable housing, they want all, good sunshine. And so we have this big population that keeps moving out into the country, and they're typically following the rivers, so it's not like a big block, it's kind of like this, And there's, every valley's got houses up and down the valley side, and so when we do have fires, it's really hard where we spend all this time protecting structures and people and lives, which is proper, but it also means you're not
doing some of the other things you might want to be doing. Here are just a couple examples of what the WUI, as we call it, the Wildland-Urban Interface. Some of that might look kind of familiar. So anyway, finally, to bring this back to the Railroad Creek and the Wolverine Fire. So going into 2015, or really the whole time I've been coming up to Holden, which goes back to the mid-70s, you know, we've really had a good situation that kind of sets us up for fire. And the really question was when, not if. However, we had some things going for us. So the downside is we had a long fire-free period. That was actually a good side from a village perspective. Occasional, you know, chalet would burn down, but we haven't had any wildfires. A couple of small ones up on the ridgetops, but nothing that really threatened until the Donkey Lake fire in, I can't remember, was that 2007 or 8? 7? Okay. I might have said 8 here later, but anyway, that was really the first one that was really much of a threat. And the reason is we've got really good fuel breaks here. Martin Ridge and Lightning Ridge, you know, if you've ever been up on top there, it's mostly rock. And so you're kind of isolated from Ten Mile Valley. If you turn around here up on Copper and Buckskin, mostly rock. And so when, you know, when the Tin Pan fire burned and some of the, you know, if the Antiot started burning, you at least have a really big fuel break there to the south. Same thing to the west. Not as obvious, but between all the rockfall and the avalanche chutes and everything else, there's just an awful lot of deciduous, you know, if you ever walked up the Heart Lake Trail, there's a lot of willow, there's a lot of alder, shrubby areas that you go through. Pretty good fuel break. It's kind of what they call shade. That's what they actually try to create in other areas now, is these shaded fuel breaks. There's some big trees, but there's a lot of wet, shrubby type vegetation. So we've had three sides covered. The best shot for ever getting a fire up here is basically something coming up from the lake. And the thing that makes that less likely is, where does the wind come from? Wind comes from a valley, blows down valley about, when I've lived here, I've thought it's about 90% of the time. I mean, when the tailing piles used to blow, where'd they blow? They blew that way. And so you basically, and you know, it's hard for fire, just as even though fire would be moving uphill, it'd be moving against the wind. So it's almost like moving downhill. So that's the good news. On the bad news, you know, there was some logging up here, particularly during the mining days and before the mining days. It took out a lot of the big trees. And so we have the same situation we have in a lot of the Northwest, where big trees were taken out and replaced by other trees that were smaller, less, you know, in this case, mostly Douglas fir and stuff that's not quite as good at handling fire as a ponderosa pine. You know, in climate, we've got every summer, nice and hot and dry, right? Mm-hmm. Some years drier than others, but it's hot and dry every year. But we don't get many ignitions down here. You know, thanks to you folks being careful with fire here, we don't have too many human ignitions. And most of the lightning tends to hit up on the ridgetops because that's the path of least resistance. So not too many natural ignitions down in the valleys. So if a fire comes, it's going to have to kind of make its way down. But we also do have that steep topography. Again, Rudy Edmond talked about the U-shaped glacial valleys. So by nature, we have very steep sides to the valleys and these broader valley bottoms. And so there's a lot of potential for chimneying action. And then, you know, the landscape continuity is another one that those, especially that north-facing slope. I once found an atlas from the 1910 Geological Survey that showed Holden the Railroad Creek Valley, and the entire thing basically said Young Lodgepole. You know, and basically it was somewhere between, I don't know, I've heard anywhere from 1880 to 1900, depending on who you're listening to and whether you've aged the trees. Somewhere there in that late 19th century, pretty much that whole thing burned. And it came back, and it probably had burned before that, but it came back as lodgepole pine, which is really what it should. I was really surprised by that because as just coming up here and hiking, I didn't notice that. I saw a lot of Douglas fir, I saw a lot of cedar, I saw a lot of other stuff. I actually went up there and started doing tree measurements and go, holy cow, there really are a lot of lodgepole. But by that time, they were being crowded out by all these other things that had come up underneath them. And so by the time Wolverine came along, a lot of those lodgepoles had actually died and fallen over. So you've got this nice continuous carpet of forest, except for where the donkey fire burned. That's another story. But, you know, so very easy to carry fire up that side. And even on this side, where there's a lot of rocky bluffs, still, the fire had been absent long enough that a lot of that was covered. One of my family members mentioned, you know, gosh, now you can look at all that rock out there. You never saw that rock before. Well, some of that was because maybe, there were shrubs in the way, but some of it was because it was just covered. It might be covered with mosses or litter or other stuff, but now it's been burned off so you can see it all. And so that connectivity on that side increased too. So anyway, I guess I'll stop there for now and basically just talk about that we were due, but there's some pretty good reasons why it happened in 2015, but it could have happened any time in the last 30 or 40 years. Oh, and I'll take whatever questions. I invite you to look at this map as you leave if you have time. It just basically shows all the different fires in north central Washington for like the last 40 or 50 years. And it's pretty impressive just how much of the area has been burned. Yeah?
Since we had such a wet winter.
Yes.
I don't know how far west, I mean east of Cape. I'm on the west side, so.
Yeah, it's pretty wet here. Not bad.
So, I mean, so does that increase the fuel because things grew well or better, or does that affect it very much?
The question was whether the wet winter affects the fuels. It affects it in two different ways. Typically, when we have a wet winter like that, you're going to have more fire out in the really dry sage and grasslands, because there the extra moisture helped more grass, more cheatgrass in particular, but other kinds of grass grow. And so, and especially if you have 2-3 years like that, you get a lot more. There are very fuel limited systems, and they're going to dry out regardless and have a pretty long fire season. So it doesn't take too much to get them going. So we've had one big fire like that this summer already. But up here, those winters, you know, it really shortens the fire season. So you still, you know, you still could get a good fire going 2 weeks from now, but the window of opportunity is much shorter. And so if you think of it sort of as a, you know, every day you roll the dice. You just don't have to roll the dice nearly as many days in a wet year like this. Yeah.
So you say that this area was due. How cognizant, do you know how cognizant they were of the potential that such a large fire could occur?
Oh, I think everybody's been aware of it. You know, it's questions how much you can do about it. There certainly have been efforts in the past, and certainly planning efforts. I was involved in a couple of them back in 1990-ish area, where there was talk, you know, about Nine Mile Creek trying to do some firewood gathering and some selective logging in there, because there had been logging done there in the 60s, so maybe you could improve the stands and at the same time create some fuel breaks. The village did work over the last decade at different times going through trying to, you know, gather up wood off the ground to try to, you know, at least create a zone around there. So, but, you know, we had not done, for various reasons, you know, no prescribed burning that I know of has ever been done in this valley, or certainly not of any magnitude. You know, it's not a place where you can kind of come in and do the classic thinning and burning restoration treatments. And really, there's just because of the nature, the wilderness nature of the area and the lower part of the sort of amusing. I mean, the lower part of the valley was a designated late successional reserve from a management point, because it had these big old trees and had some spotted owls had lived there at one time. And when we came in after the wolverine, I said, well, are you going to plant this? Oh, no, it's late successional reserve. Not for another 200 years, it's not. But, you know, so there are all these kind of complicating factors I think more than anything else, we can't treat anywhere near the amount of acres that we need to. And so, you know, maybe this will focus more attention on the value of Holden, and or maybe Holden partnering with the Forest Service and others might lead to some future activity, especially with some of the work that's gone on this summer. Yeah.
I was wondering, this is maybe beyond the scope of here, but man's ability to control fire in a corporate sense certainly has been pretty recent, right? In the last century. I mean, they didn't control fire much in actively in, say, before 1800 or 1900. Right. There was not much active fire control. Is that correct? Because we didn't have the ability to do it, the organizational tools to do it.
Well, yeah, humans, I mean, at least in this neck of the woods, I mean, if, depending how far east you are, but I mean, in this neck of the woods, there wasn't really, there weren't very many people before 1850 or so. And so it's probably pretty negligible. But then, you know, once you start, you know, there's a lot of passive stuff. Like I said, the road building, the community building. Again, the Native Americans were probably burning a lot of the low areas.
Slash and burn, right?
A lot of that was burning stuff that we would have thought of as a low-severity fire regime anyway. So they may have, like, instead of having fires burn on average every 5 years, it may have been burning every 2 years. But a lot of that came, at least there's some thought that a lot of that came after Spanish horses were introduced. And if you're going to try to move your horse around, you want to get rid of a lot of underbrush and keep things open. And there were also, it's sort of a form of, I guess if you would call slash and burn agriculture, that you're favoring certain species that were good food. So we, in a way, we kind of stopped that and then went way the other, we moved the pendulum way over to the other end.
And maybe you can't answer it, but you know, I can think of similar landscapes in Europe that were had, you know, high urbanization much earlier. What was their ability to control fires in alpine towns where there were still, you know, significant assets a long time ago? Is there a history of it that got transported from a European culture to American culture?
We could probably go on that a long time. I think the biggest thing was sort of a philosophical command and control kind of, I mean, people come up with different names for it, but, you know, the European thing is order, right? We want to order our existence. We want to be efficient. We want to create this. We brought a lot of tools, a lot of different tool sets. I mean, a lot of people talk about native peoples burning because that was one of the few tools they really had that was effective at affecting large-scale landscapes. I mean, so, you know, you don't have, whereas, you know, once you start bringing along many of the other technologies that the Europeans brought with them, they were able to affect more. But I think a lot of it, Paul Hesburgh had written about, was really, as much as anything, this idea of what's man's role in nature, and are we here to subdue and subject and to bring order to chaos, or are we here to sort of live as part of nature? That's the best answer I can give you. We could probably have an off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe an interesting discussion. Yeah.
You mentioned somewhat about selective logging here. What about clear-cut logging? Is that a good thing or a bad thing for an area like this?
It depends on how much you do and where you do it. From an ecological point of view, clear cutting is akin to what you get in a lodgepole pine forest. And clear cutting is supposed to mimic a high severity fire regime. If you want to look at the sort of the theoretical basis for clear cutting, if you're on the west side outside of Seattle, part of the reason clear cutting was developed in the first place, besides efficiency, was that it mimicked the reforestation conditions that would have been typical after a high severity wildfire. So that is, if you're expecting the wildfire is going to come through and kill all the trees and then the seedlings are going to establish in this bright open area without much competition, then you could justify clear cutting as mimicking natural disturbance. Around here, I mean, like the Ponderosa pine is sort of the opposite. They're built to withstand disturbance, and so when you do get mortality, it's typically very small patches that then will, you know, so you have this very, you know, patches the size of this room or less. So you may get a cluster of trees that die for random chance or because of some unique problem, but in general you expect the fire to go through and not much. And so, you know, lodgepole pine would be the one around here where if you were doing commercial forestry with lodgepole pine, which nobody does, but that would be where you would say, okay, yeah, let's clear it. And I've seen that in the Call Bill. They've done that before where they've harvested lodgepole pine, run fire through it to, they leave the cones on the ground, run fire through it to open the cones up, release the seed onto the seed bed, and then it comes back really well. So it is a viable way. I don't think you do so much of that here because what you really want to, if you do that around here, especially under the current condition, what you're going to get is what I'm afraid they're going to get after this fire. And we can talk about this on Friday, but you kind of get all these shade tolerant trees that are growing in refuge places where the fire wasn't so hot. They're the ones dumping all the seed in there, and so you get trees that are even less adapted to fire than what you had before. So you're actually kind of going the wrong direction instead of favored, you know. And so that's why typically when we're in dry forest, when we're trying to do restoration, we're doing thin from below. We're trying to mimic fire by taking out the smaller trees, even some that maybe fire wouldn't get but would have gotten 20 years ago. We try to take those out and leave the really big ones behind because they're the ones that can be sustainable through time.
Yeah, so when I'm out hiking, and I'm looking for the signs of the forest rejuvenating or coming back, what do I look for, and what species of pine are you seeing? Are they up yet?
You know, it's real early. I have crews out there. And this is only the second year after fire. So what we're really looking for in the second year after fire, and we'll talk about this again on Friday, but we're really looking for just something to cover up the soil. Lucy, you probably could tell us, are we finding many seedlings out there?
Good amount.
Good.
Just a lot of ponderosa, a lot of Devil's Grape.
Good. See, she knows more than I do on this because she's the one actually collecting the information.
Down in Central Oregon, they do a lot of ladder fuel reduction to help them mitigate fire, especially around.
Sure.
Is that a thought up here?
It's just really expensive.
Yeah.
You know, you have to, you know, you potentially, you could decide that there's an area within X number of meters of the village that was worth putting that expense into. Or, you know, that could be a really good part of, say, a shaded fuel break a mile down the valley or something where you might.
Ladder fuel
production? Sorry, ladder fuel treatments?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the idea, I didn't cover that very well. So surface fire is one thing. Fire can burn along the surface, and it's going to do a certain amount of, it's going to burn up fuels, and it's going to burn up a lot of shrubs and stuff like that. But where the fires typically get damaging to forest is when they manage to get from the forest floor up into the tree canopies. And the way they do that is typically through some sort of what we call ladder fuel. Ladder fuels can be, you know, you could have an open grown tree that has branches going all the way down to the ground, so the lower branches ignite and then they ignite the higher branches. So lodgepole pine typically does that, either through needles or just they hold on to the branches so the fire can just go through the tree itself. More commonly around here, what you have is small trees growing under big trees, and especially if you have big trees, medium-sized trees, and little trees, the little trees catch on fire, they catch the medium-sized trees on fire, the medium-sized trees catch the big trees on fire, and pretty soon it's all burned. And so with any kind of restoration treatment, one of the goals of that, besides reducing overall fuels, is to reduce the connectivity, particularly vertical connectivity, to keep whatever fire comes through on the ground and not let it get up into the canopy, or if it does, just in like a single tree. So we try to cut that bridge between the surface and canopy and then reduce the canopy so they can't jump so well from one tree to another. So you could, you know, the thing with the ladder field, that's great, you know, for urban interface stuff where they're really trying to create defensible space and where they can allow burnout operations or something like that to come through. But you have to be pretty, it just costs a lot, so you have to be pretty strategic as to where you put it.
Has there been any interesting or surprising discoveries you've heard of in terms of fire research in the past 5 or 10 years that have fundamentally changed any new approaches?
Ooh.
It's kind of broad, I know. I'm sorry.
Good. I think we're learning a lot more all the time. I think we're learning a lot about the resilience of different forest ecosystems to fire. I think we're getting a better handle on, you know, just how well things will recover. You know, my stuff, my research and where I read a lot about is sort of forest management practices and how they relate to fire and how effective fuel reduction treatments are, and we can talk some about that on Friday. But can I answer that maybe later? Let me think on that while if there's any other question. I don't have a good answer. I wish I did. That's a really good question. Yeah.
We were hiking to Monkey Bear this morning, and on our way back, we walked down to the road, and there was a little tiny, some kind of a fir tree, whatever, that I'm assuming grew after the fire, and it's about knee high, and I said, that's the future of our forest right there, so. Anyway, it was pretty cool to see the little trees growing, so they're out there.
Yeah, if it was that tall, it probably survived the fire, but you're right about it being the future of the forest. And that's, you know, that's why Lucy and those folks the Schlein District specifically asked us to, while we were doing our vegetation surveys, to pay attention to that. Partly because they have a legal requirement to make sure it's going to come back before they have to do something active, but partly also just because it gives us a really early indication of what it's going to look like down the road. And second year is a little hard to tell because, you know, we could have a massive drought next year, and a lot of the stuff that's coming back from the fire might die next year and not survive. Once you get about 5 or 10 years old, you have a much better idea that they're going to live. But that is it, and that's why I want to look at what's coming back and where the seed sources are. My colleague Paul Hesberg, who I put a couple slides up from that, I remember about 10 years ago we went to a fire in Oregon. And we were on a tour with a whole bunch of people looking at this bad fire and all this stuff. And I made a comment that really stuck with me, which was that, you know, again, the problem with that fire was that between the fire and logging, they had taken out all of the pines that were really going to be the species. And then what was coming back was a lot of true firs and stuff that had been basic, you know, pointing out all these little refuges along stream corridors and, you know, wet areas that had survived this fire. And that's what's going to reseed. And those areas have always, I mean, historically, they've always survived. And that's, you know, so that these fire-sensitive species, they always seem to find, you know, a few little nooks and crannies where it's wet enough and everything that they can survive. And then over the next, you know, so 30 years, they kind of can spread out. But then the next fire comes out, and they're back in their little hole. You know, it's sort of like this constant, you know, battle between fire and their ability to... What we've done has changed a lot, but meanwhile, out in that other stuff, you would have had these really big trees that were just hanging out and saying, "Hey, I'm still here. You know, you got to deal with me." And now we don't have those big trees, in many cases. Yeah.
After St. Helens blew,
yes,
and the forest, the restoration of that area, is that much different from the restoration of, say, the Wolverine Fire or fire?
Oh. Yeah, pretty different, but also, in many respects the same. I think, you know, St. Helens was pretty violent disturbance, even compared to, I mean, you know, and think about what, again, it's sort of like the difference between wind and fire. I mean, except that, so what St. Helens essentially was a massive windstorm that flattened miles and miles of forest, you know, laid them all down, and then the actual eruption that covered a lot of that with, you know, a meter of stuff. So what St. Helens has a combination of problems of coming back from is that, you know, any seeds were down a meter or so, and some have actually come up. I mean, they've learned a lot about people, you know, the ability of those. In many cases, a lot of pocket gophers and stuff like that survived in their holes and have managed through by eating stuff and bringing it up to the surface, you know, and sort of eat poop, you know, that they've actually managed to bring a lot of those propagules up to the surface and recolonize areas. So areas that looked really dead turned out not to be quite so dead because this small mammal activity, and there's probably some bugs doing the same thing, but the small mammals, the ones I'm familiar with. But then you also have this problem that, you know, in areas where it wasn't so devastated, I mean, wind typically takes out the big stuff and releases all the little stuff. So if you get further out where it wasn't so devastating, you probably have a lot of hemlocks and stuff coming back. So in that regard, it's a little different. It's a different kind of disturbance, but, you know, it's the same thing. You're starting over at some level. And we'll talk on Friday about just how far back the fire set us and what their prospects for recovery are. But
This might be a better question for Friday, but when doing land management after a fire as big as this, how high is the priority in returning the landscape to be the exact same in terms of species diversity and like percentage that it was before the fire. Are you looking to like recreate that same forest, or is there an understanding that the fire will fundamentally have changed what lives in and what percentage?
Yeah, I don't think there's any particular drive to put it back the way it was. I mean, I think if anything, people would argue that it's an opportunity to put it on a better trajectory or more sustainable path. But you know, in this valley, because there's so much wilderness area, I mean, the dominant theme is leave it alone, let's see what happens. In fact, I found myself arguing on the opposite side of that, like, don't you think you ought to do a little bit? With these values at risk here, you know, maybe you shouldn't be totally wilderness, you know, maybe okay to like do a little. And we're seeing that this summer. I mean, there's been this log removal contract, for example, that's a response to the fire, and that's a combination of, you know, maybe they'll get some value from the wood, maybe it'll just provide Holden with firewood for the next 20 years, or you know, build a new chalet someplace or something. But from I've been on a couple of the trips where the Forest Service was evaluating that, and really the big concern there was both, well, public safety in the first place, and then future fire danger in the second, and wanting to make sure that that road corridor is as safe as we can make it, so that if we ever have to evacuate again, they feel like they have options for getting people out.
So how much does politics override good science?
We don't have enough time.
I'm into forestry in the Pacific Northwest.
Budgets overwhelm good forestry. Politics sometimes. Politics, what I call politics, I would say get in the way of getting things done. I don't know that there's too many people that, I mean, you can probably find examples. I don't hear too many people complaining that I wanted to do this, but somebody told me to do that. I do know one really good example, but that's pretty rare. I mean, for the most part, there is a sense that the on-the-ground managers need to make the decisions, and within. So I don't feel too bad about that, but there's no question politics get way in the way of funding. So, you know, the easier thing is, we're not going to tell you can't do it, but by the way, you're not going to have any money to do it. And in order to do that, you're going to spend the next 10 years writing up documents and defending them in court. And that's politics on both sides. I mean, that's every, you know, so many things, like many parts of our society right now, people are just spoiling for a fight. And you know, and there, and so you get a lot of conflict where, you know, we had this conversation earlier today in some context. You know, we're not really at a point socially right now, I don't think, where everybody wants to sit down at the table and find common ground. I mean, we're really more in a, I think it's just a social mood where we want to win a battle. And I think that gets in the way, that's the kind of politics I think gets in the way of good forest management. You know, we might make some mistakes, but we generally know what to do. And we generally have some pretty decent tools for how to do it. What we don't have is permission and funding to do it. Yeah.
Has any of this historic knowledge of like the species and scape of this forest influenced the what Rio Tinto has been planting all along the tailings here?
I hope so. you know, I got up there with my kids this afternoon a little bit, just not a very scientific, because, you know, we're supposed to stay off the mulch, so we really were trying to reinforce that. But yeah, I mean, what it looks like, and I've talked to the silviculturists and stuff, that they're basically trying to put a lot of lodgepole in, which, not my favorite species, but it makes a lot of sense. It's the most hardy for growing on crummy sites. It'll make, you know, it should grow pretty fast, and you know, if it's not overly dense, it's pretty easy to be invaded by other species. So it may pave the way for other species to come in afterward. Yeah, no big arguments on that. I think they're doing a good job. They're trying to, you know, like anything else, I think there's always uncertainty and stuff. And so one guy created this thing called Options Forestry, and I think it's a great title. What was the plan itself with all that greater up? But I mean, the idea is give yourself and give nature some options. If you're going to go plant some different stuff, and let nature, you know, let nature and stuff sort out which thing wins and which thing doesn't win. And you try to put all your eggs in one basket, you know, then you're setting yourself up for a lot of failure and you know, unexpected stuff. But, you know, if we can create species diversity, if we can get genetic diversity, you know, and then, you know, let a higher authority figure out which one wins.
Events are coming up Wednesday and Friday. What time?
Yeah, we're going to talk Wednesday, the same time slot, I believe, in the same, you know, same bat time, same bat channel. and then Friday is a late afternoon session, I believe, and it's going to be a big side. I think it's 3:45 or 4. Well, thank you so much. Vespers will be starting.